Greetings. I'm Josh Tyson, co-author of Age of Invisible Machines, the first best-selling book about conversational AI. Age of Invisible Machines explores the learnings of industry veteran and OneReach.ai CEO Rob Wilson. Each week, Rob and I bring in a guest to continue the conversations we started in the pages of our book. This week on the Invisible Machines podcast, we're talking about the changing role of experienced designers in the wake of generative AI, why the core tenets of design thinking will always be critical to businesses, and how designers can adapt their skills as conversational AI continues to change our interactions with technology. Our guest is Aaron Cooper, Senior Director of Digital Experience at Banner Health. Aaron has led the creation of multiple products involving conversational AI at companies like Honeywell and Optum Health. He was generous enough to open up about what he's looking for when hiring conversational design talent and how he makes sure that key people within his organization are partners in design. This episode is an excellent resource for folks on both sides of the hiring equation in the realm of conversational design. We have also got a special guest host, Elias Parker, the executive producer of our book, Age of Invisible Machines, and of this podcast. An ethnographer by training, Elias has been working with UX practitioners for more than a decade and has hired over 200 researchers and designers across disciplines. Elias and I have often worked in tandem around operations at UX Magazine over the years, and this was a great opportunity to compare notes and see what's changed in design hiring over the past decade and what might never change. So get ready for a practical and engaging conversation with Aaron Cooper of Banner Health. Invisible Machines is produced in partnership with OneReach.ai. Their Generative Studio X platform is the only orchestration platform that's been named a leader by every major analyst group. Enterprises and other organizations are already using GSX to create technology ecosystems where they can grow their own digital teammates called intelligent digital workers. These IDWs can be set to work with hundreds of customizable skills utilizing GSX's no-code building tools. Head to OneReach.ai to test drive an IDW and experience the next phase of generative AI. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us. We are really, really excited to have you here with us.
Yeah, thank you. Excited to talk in a way that will hopefully help a lot of professionals as they hire and try to find the right talent.
Definitely. Absolutely. And Elias, a pleasure seeing you here.
Always. Yeah, nice to see you again, Aaron.
I see it as well. Yep.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different aspects of looking for design talent that we can cover, but I think one of the things that we found interesting right away was that when you were at Honeywell, it looked like you designed some cool kind of internal facing automations, which is sort of a path that we advise in our book that, that companies take if they're trying to kind of implement conversational AI. So realizing that this was, you know, several years ago that you were doing this, we thought it might be interesting to talk a bit about like the challenges you faced then, and then kind of like how things have changed since then, because there have been so many kind of seismic developments in those years. Right. So,
right. And, you know, really it all started with efficiency as the conversation, right? Whether that was cost efficiency, cost takeout for human resources, you know, you have human resources professionals in call centers trying to answer questions of employees. Could be anything from what's my pay slip, when's my next check coming, what's my vacation time looking like, to, you know, leave of absence, whatever that might be. Could be a manager wanting to understand what's my regrettable turnover look like. So it really spanned personas, employees, as well as managers, and it spanned technologies as well. So when you're trying to drive cost out of an employee contact center, and as the case was there, we were just looking at every way we could do that, whether it was through the interactive voice response and really promoting self-service options through our human resources application. So we were looking for ways to essentially enable different tiers of service within human resources. If you think about that hand-holding that a manager might want to complete a task, for instance, I need to post a new job requisition. Do they need hand-holding for that? They might be wanting to move an employee to a different manager, another example, right? So we would look across the personas, managers as well as employees, look at their use cases, maybe their jobs to be done, right? The things that they were trying to accomplish more efficiently, more cost effectively, more successfully. And that's where it kind of all began. And as we started to look at virtual assistant technology, chatbot technology, at least back then, it was a bit more challenging. You had to have middleware. It was challenging to connect to data, such as from Oracle or other systems, in order to actually resolve directly within the chat. Because it can be pretty frustrating if you're interacting, especially nowadays with the rise of ChatGPT, where you get immediate answers. It could be pretty frustrating back then if all you got as a response was, you know, go to this area of a website, that's where you'll find your answer, rather than an actual answer that resolved your issue. So we started to look at call center volumes. Where are we getting the most volume? Which are the most complex issues? Which are the ones that could actually be managed by a self-service? Like I mentioned, how's my payslip looking, you know? Well, you probably could do that self-service. You could already do that through a human resources portal, but it was a number of clicks to get there. It was a little buried. It was kind of hard to find versus just going to a chatbot and typing in payslip.
Yeah.
And then immediately verifying that the person was who they said they were and showing their pay right there a lot faster. So that was another big consideration with that type of self-service is, if we introduce this, are we actually introducing efficiency or not? Is this actually easier than just what we might now call a traditional visual interface, where I sign in, it's personalized, I'm seeing some of these things immediately. So we really had to find that intersection of where it truly was more efficient as the way of getting that job done, as well as where we had the data connectivity, the ability to actually display the information the person needed, as well as how many steps would it take? How much information would we need to know from the person in order to answer the question effectively? So
at that moment, still somewhat true today, although to a lesser degree, there weren't many like incredible models to look at, especially when it comes to, like as Josh said, in his book with Rob Wilson, they recommend starting internally and starting small. You did at least part of that. What you were doing wasn't exactly small. Maybe you did get the opportunity to start small, but you started internally. There aren't a lot of great models for these, for successful conversational applications, certainly years ago when you did this, and then put on top of that internal proprietary stuff, even fewer, like way harder to find models. Did you find a model? Was your team able to operate from a model, or was it like true Wild West sort of stuff for you guys?
I would have to say it was a little bit more Wild West. You know, there were virtual assistants that were more kind of treed, scripted interactions that would, you'd ask a question and it would give you an answer, more of a Q&A. That was available. That's been available for quite some time. There was ask a question, get a menu of buttons in a chatbot. You tap one of them and then you kind of get more information. But really that starts to feel a lot like a traditional interface. So is there really value in that? We actually ended up winning an Oracle Innovation Award because we were going well beyond just question and answer. And we were able to get to interactions like, I'm an employee, I need to change my address. I'm a manager, I need to move an employee to another manager. I want to see my payslip. Things that are sometimes called killer apps on intranets within companies, we were actually able to bring those into a chat interaction, contain the answer. We also had the ability to warm transfer to an agent, and the agent would have the context of what that person had already entered. What we might call those utterances mapped to those intents. They would have that information so that they could take the conversation from there. And that middleware was necessary because there wasn't a good interface for training machine learning at that time, where you would get an utterance, it didn't quite map to an intent, and so it failed for the person. So we needed an interface where we could see where that was happening and then do that mapping and try to correct the situation for subsequent chats.
And what was the transition like for your design team? Because this project is considerably different than, you know, designing visual UI elements and things like that. What was that like? And is that kind of what spurred maybe the beginnings of kind of looking for new types of talent in certain situations?
It really did, because I quickly realized that there was this thing called a conversation designer or a conversational designer, and there's a reason for that. And it was because people were used to creating pretty much linear flows within a visual interface aren't necessarily as attuned to behavior design. What prompts should we use to actually trigger the right behavior? How a conversation flows and branches, and how you need to be able to capture that information to give the right contained response. I mean, when you think about it, a chatbot, I don't know to what extent this happens with like ChatGPT and current, you know, interactions, what you might call prompt engineering. But back then, people would just type in one word sometimes to a chat, and it might just be pay or vacation. You don't really know at that point exactly the question they're asking. So how do you then prompt again to get clarity without annoying the person, you know, that sort of thing. So it had me starting to look for conversation designers, people who were more experienced in designing those types of interactions, which were a little bit more free form. And I found some fantastic people. I'll give a shout out to Alicia Torres, who is absolutely fantastic. She ended up being the person who really unlocked our ability to create conversational flows. And she had that experience. It even challenged things like, hey, we're working in Sketch and Envision at the time. Maybe that's not the best place, the most efficient place to try to map out a whole conversational flow, right? So what software was available to do that?
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think sometimes on this podcast, we've talked about how conversational AI, in a sense, kind of marks the next phase of experience design. If you think of it in terms of like creating experiences with less friction, like being able to talk to technologies pretty frictionless, right. But there is a bit of a gap there, right? That I'm kind of seeing more now, that it doesn't, just because it's the next phase of experience design, doesn't mean that all the skills that experience designers have built up over the years are going to like make a clean transfer into this new phase.
Right. How does an interface designer design an interaction for the rabbit R1? Right.
Yeah.
Where you're speaking to it, or you're holding up to your refrigerator to see what's in your fridge and it's recommending a recipe for the evening. You know, what does that interaction look like? How much design does there even need to be once you've been able to train the machine? Right.
Yeah.
And I've been saying that for a number of years, that it's kind of like, you go back to Dieter Rams, and it's kind of like good design, it's the least design possible.
Right.
We're starting to see that, right? Like, what does interface mean, you know, in the future?
Right. Something we were talking about is in our research leading up to this conversation is, Josh got us started down that path, but what did you need in a designer then? And How is that different now? Like what did it look like then? Where has it gone to in terms of like who is the right?
That's really interesting. Yeah, because if you look at if we look to the future even a little bit more in future cast, you know, and this idea of what is interface, typically in design, we've had a number of competencies that we've looked at as leaders, right? We've looked at visual design, interaction design, the ability to research and gather insights, content design, accessibility. These are all included in a framework that I actually use with my designers today. I call it a design practice area evaluation. And we do that as part of our growth and development discussions. You know, I know that you help people grow, or you watch them go. That's kind of how it works. And so how do I help my designers really grow in a way that makes them a little bit more future-proof, helps them understand where some of their blind spots are? But back to your question, you know, if I look at the future of design, I think it pivots more towards helpful kind of companion automation of design. Are we going to have designers really pushing pixels to organize, assign, and screen? Probably not. That's been done many times over. There's good patterns for that. We have machines that can recognize those patterns and lay that out pretty efficiently for us. And ideally in the future, machines are doing that also with cognizance of, you know, usability testing data that's been collected over time and what is successful and what's not. So I think we'll see that kind of core focus of design as it's been over the years erode pretty rapidly over the next 5 years. You hear Jacob Nielsen talk about it quite a bit as well. You know, either either learn AI or you become a dinosaur, right? And I'm glad to see people like Jacob doing that because he's been such an influence in user experience over the years, and he's seeing it and recognizing it. So as I work with my current designers, as I hire people, I'm really looking for someone who is even more skilled in areas of design facilitation, maybe jobs to be done, maybe behavior design, really understanding the needs of people that might be unmet, underserved, to really get to what we're trying to get to. Oftentimes is not just the table stakes ease of use, but the innovation. I define innovation in a certain way. You'll see it on my LinkedIn profile. It's new value from new experiences. That's how I define innovation. Sometimes you'll hear me say a spike of value from new experiences. That's how you know when there's that punctuation, that's an innovation. It could be destructive, but it's new value either way. So I'm looking for designers who will be able to, whether they're working with product managers, developers, other roles as those change in organizations over the years, maybe a machine learning trainer or a conversational designer, that they're able to move from unmet needs to ideas around how to resolve those regardless of the interface. You know, we've called that design thinking over the years too. If you think about it, I was trained by Jonathan Ball with the UK Design Council when I worked with Luma Institute. And, you know, when we talked about the double diamond, that really elevated my kind of my thoughts as a leader of designers, that I really need to focus more on the first diamond, you know, the ability for them to really discover, flare, and then focus or diverge and then converge before you get to delivering something. Because I think that's more where our value is going to be in the future.
Yeah, you know, that makes me kind of think of one of Rob's favorite questions that we can ask in his absence. Like, we're talking about things that might change or that you're seeing already change within the design discipline, but what's not going to change? Like, what kind of indisputable skill sets are there going to be? I think maybe that first diamond points to some of them.
I think it does.
Let me jump in for one quick sec there. I want to add a bit of a caveat to Josh's question. Not just what's not going to change in like a future casting sense. Let's also do that. That's interesting. But what have you seen so far? Like, you were working on conversational experiences, serious ones, before arguably really the overwhelming majority of people that are now in the space even touched it, right?
Right.
What might we see as future cast, but also like what hasn't changed so far?
Yeah. What hasn't changed is the need for empathy, I would say. You know, my background is I was pre-seminary in college at Concordia University in Wisconsin. I was going to be a pastor. I think I did that because I wanted to help people. But then I moved into psychology in my sophomore year, right? Got more into cognition and behavior. And that kind of stuck with me. And then I graduated, went to graduate school for counseling psychology, and was designing websites on the side to pay for graduate school, and decided to flip to that. So I've actually had an interesting path, but what has always remained, what's always remained important is that ability to empathize and that desire to really help people help themselves, which I think ultimately is what design does. It helps people help themselves, right? And so you can say self-service, sometimes that has some negative connotations to it, but if we think of it as people helping themselves, I think that's important. And I think that endures. You know, if I think about my day-to-day business, whether it's at my current employer or previous, often the time when design delivers the most value is when we pivot the conversation from a technology enabler to what is the person's actual need. When we pivot the conversation from what's feasible using a certain platform or technology? We're talking about React and what can you pivot that conversation to? Well, here's what I heard in an interview with a customer. Here's what I saw when I went out and did some research with a customer. And I noticed this workaround that they were finagling with. We could help them be so much more efficient. That's where design typically brings value. When you empathize and you bring it back to the customer, back to the patient, whoever that person is that's interacting with you. I don't like to say user. It's just a horrible word, I think. So I think that doesn't change. I'm always looking for people. When I interview, I'm looking for people who can pause, who who are clearly actively listening because they're reflecting back to me, who have high emotional intelligence, because ultimately you want that to be the brand of a company. Just about any company wants that, you know, that ability to empathize with their customers. So look for that in the designer. That's one thing that doesn't change.
Would you accept if I said you could paraphrase what you've described and basically bring it all back to like core design principles? Like that so far is immovable. And let's still get to your future casting, but now I'm thinking like, well, does that mean the interface and the actual experience that we're delivering, like the extension and application of those core principles, the artifacts that we're creating, are those now like trivial? And if that's the case, is that also true of like the tools and the technologies? Because you also said, well, designers need to like have this technology prowess and like, you know, understand what's happening in the technology space, maybe in a different way than 3 years ago, even 2 years ago, 1 year ago. If those core design principles are still there, maybe even more important with your hiring, it sounds like some of the work becomes trivial then, like the interface itself, does it become trivial?
Well, again, what is the interface, right? If we mean visual design for visual interfaces, especially with the rise of design systems, does that become more trivial? I think it actually becomes more important because the little visual design that you do that differentiates your brand or your application, your interface from others, becomes that much more important. Even though the things that become common, like forms and how you interact with form fields, becomes almost irrelevant. Maybe you don't even see those as much anymore. I think the little visual design that you do becomes that much more important. It's kind of like what happened with print design, right? Back in the day, I used to design for Hogtails magazine and others, and everyone said, oh, print is dying. What actually happened is print became somewhat of a premium, right?
Yeah.
And as things move to digital. So there, I think there are certain competencies, though, that become more and more important. And I think conversation design is one of them. I think design facilitation and ideation and effectively drawing out new and novel approaches to solve problems becomes that much more important. And like I said, kind of that emotional intelligence. Because really, what's interesting, too, is the interfaces are becoming more human. You think about what they used to be back in the day of HyperCards on an earlier Mac or Flash, you know, and skeuomorphism, you know, as an attempt to try to make things more relatable and look even more like things that you use every day, right? We've seen those changes over time in design to try to become more human. And now we see that with things like ChatGPT. We see things like that with the Figure, a partnership with OpenAI, trying to create robots that are a little bit more human. Well, isn't that interesting? So as the interface becomes more human, it becomes even more necessary for us to figure out how to use that in a way that doesn't become uncanny and creepy, but
yeah,
in a way that actually more efficiently helps people get their jobs done. And so those other disciplines within design become that much more important. I'm not saying visual design isn't important, but I think schools, universities should focus even more on design thinking or the remnants of it and how that changes more into behavior design, conversational design.
Okay.
Yeah, what you said about visual design is kind of interesting. About like, I've been looking at videos of WeChat, of people using WeChat, and you know, it's sort of like just this one conversational interface that people use to do all sorts of things. And there are opportunities for brands to kind of jump into that ecosystem. I think they're called like mini apps.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, kind of to what you were saying, there are now like these more narrow opportunities to insert a bit of visual design. So in a way, like it becomes even more important that you get it right in these little moments. And then they also kind of have to combine somehow with your brand voice to kind of create this sense of who you are as a company in this like fleeting moment that a person might engage with you, because it seems
right.
Like more and more engagement might kind of become conversational, yeah. Like that. It's not going to be like looking at websites necessarily.
I mean, what are we doing now? So really looking, and that's pretty cool to see the technology has brought us to the point where we can create interfaces that are in some ways more like us.
So I know that you will share some of this experience. You were hiring in 2012 in the UX space. And
so it's
I know that Josh knows this because being editor of UX Magazine back in the day in that same time period, but hiring back then, there were all these different sort of UX creatures around us and emerging and taking stronger shapes. The seat at the business table was kind of starting to happen, but not fully yet in around then. But there were all these sort of different types of UX people, which is unfair, but that was kind of what was happening in a way. Like you would go out to hire and you'd say, well, no, we need somebody that's more visual and less interaction-y for this. No, this needs somebody that's strong in both. And there were, and other, you know, types of things like that. I think some of what you're saying could be deduced to say like, no, we need the people that are strong in all the core competencies and principles of design and design thinking, but then also are like magically skilled in all the various facets of design as well. And that's going to bubble up into this incredible conversational design leader.
Right. Now, I think one of the things, you know, you were talking earlier, Elias, about things that change, things that don't. One of the things that hasn't changed is my perspective on T people, or what sometimes was called
the T-shaped talent
specialist. Yeah, T-shaped talent. Yeah. You know, talking with Peter Maraholtz, I think it was at an Adaptive Path UX intensive course way back in the day. You know, we remember sitting on the sidelines talking with him about T people and T-shaped talent. I still think that way. You know, I think to the extent I might need to hire someone who is really well-versed in maybe prompt engineering, although that even that's becoming passe pretty quickly, but the ability to create conversations using text and voice, I might want someone really deep in that, but I'm also going to need that person to complement others and stretch to do research to understand needs. I might also need that person to stretch and use some of their skills to design content for more traditional interfaces. So yeah. I really do think in terms of T-shaped talent, I don't typically look for unicorns in product designers that I hire. I might look for a little bit more of that from managers and directors.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one of the things I often say to my team, or like when I'm asked, as I was earlier today in a business meeting on Microsoft Teams, right? Everyone introduces themselves. And I don't introduce myself saying, you know, I'm a senior director of digital experience. I introduce myself by saying I'm a designer who leads designers, right?
Cool.
I want my team to hear that and know that because then they know I can empathize with them. But yeah, I think T-shaped talent is actually a really important principle.
That's awesome. I think we saved a few people that might have been close to the ledge as they were hearing that and interpreting like,
right. Oh God, I have to be unicorn.
But
let's face it, it's pretty scary, right? At the rapid pace that things are developing around AI and machine learning, I'm sure I'm not the only one who has looked on LinkedIn recently or other venues, medium elsewhere, and said, wow, I'm really behind the curve. I need to learn. Like, I need to spend 6 hours this weekend doing some prompt engineering. I need to do an hour here figuring out whether this tool that my team might use for design is actually valuable or not. And then we all know we have lives and family, and right? So I think there's a good sense of urgency, and there's a healthy sense of urgency. Tinker, play, try things out. But, I wouldn't expect to hire someone today who is, you know, has 2 years of experience in AI and machine learning conversation design, all combined into one individual. I don't think that's realistic. So have the sense of urgency. Do play and tinker. That's extremely important. I hope that did bring people back from the edge a little bit.
Hearing you talk about people playing and tinkering makes me think of generative AI and how, you know, in some respects, it closes some of those gaps like that we're talking about. Like, you might not necessarily need someone to design you an interface if they can have a generative tool make it. In that case, maybe you actually just kind of need their design sensibility more than their like ability to build something. But then there's also like scary areas where, you know, UX research kind of tends to be overlooked, I think. And so people just like using, you know, generated research content, it could also be kind of a bad thing for design. So I guess what I'm saying is it feels like generative AI kind of shifts it a little bit because it changes some of the core competencies, but then also puts others at risk.
I think it
does. Do you see it that way?
I do. My team was recently looking at and evaluating, I don't know if I should say the name or not, it was a startup that has an app that can be used to do research with users that are not real people based on a corpus of data they might have, right? And we were evaluating that because I do that with my team and say, hey, here's five or six new, you know, AI-enabled tools that have come out recently. Let's vote on it, see if we want to try it out. We tried out Writer for Figma. We've tried out other things. We decided not to do it. It just kind of went to the core of design and research, and that you got to do design with real people. You just do. There's nuances that come out when you speak with a human being that you just aren't going to get. Now, I may look back 5 years from now and at this interview and go, I can't believe I said that, because now we're using this tool. It may have a use in certain acute areas where you want to get some quick feedback to understand if there's any major issues with what you're crafting, for instance, right? But it is true. I'm hard-pressed to think that we're going to give up the ability to talk with real human beings to understand what their needs are or observe. You know, Margaret Mead, famous anthropologist, once said, what people say, what people think, or what people say, what people do, and what people say they do are very different things. And that really speaks to the core of who we are as human beings and the ability to observe those things through body language and other ways. So I think the trifecta of design going forward, right, becomes that ability to empathize and create conversations, to do the research, to understand people's, you know, unmet, underserved needs. And then this amalgamation of kind of design craft that's going to change over time. You know, the ability to do interaction design of specific components within a form or something like that is going to change, because that's not the interface we're going to use in the future. But research is extremely important. Like I talked about earlier, that double diamond, that's a large part of what that first diamond is all about. It's observing and getting with human beings to understand what their needs are.
Like at OneReach, when we're kind of thinking about the conversational design space, like when we think of someone being kind of an expert conversational designer, we kind of put a benchmark at like 10, like maybe they've designed 10 conversational experiences out in the wild. And it feels like there aren't like a ton of those people in the space. There are a lot of kind of self-selectors who are, you know, are proclaiming expertise in certain areas. And then there are like people who are brilliant conversational designers who don't know it yet because they've never really designed a conversation. I mean, we've had experiences like that. One of our most prolific experience builders came to the company with a biology degree and really not a lot of technical expertise, but just having that right mindset and kind of, I guess, like some of those like soft skills almost that come with design thinking. So how do you go about navigating the talent pool when you're looking for conversational designers, I guess, for lack of a more distinct term?
One simple answer, portfolio. That's always been the case. I think that is one thing, again, that will not change. I remember I interviewed for a firm way back in the day. Their name was Grace, Sunder, and Pressure. Which was pretty funny in and of itself. But, you know, I was just out of school. I had done a little bit of spec work, done a little bit of freelance, and I went interviewed with them. And I was talking with them about my experience. I had like one or two samples to show, and they said, portfolio. We love you. You have great interpersonal skills, but we need to see more work, you know? And so I'm the same way. Every designer that I hire, I need to see their portfolio. Conversational designers, I go one step deeper. And I look, is this, again, a simple Q&A kind of interaction? Are they able to resolve jobs to be done, you know, things that people need to be able to accomplish in the moment, in that text or voice interaction? I look more deeply at that. And then I also look at the metrics, measures of success, because ultimately, that's what we need to be able to express to our business. You know, what impact did this have for the business? How did this make this easier for the customer? So portfolio, absolutely.
Like in portfolios, are you seeing more, I guess maybe because this is like a newer field, like are people just somehow kind of packaging experiments that they've done with available technology?
I see some of that. I do. And yeah. I can tell when that's the case. Again, if there's no metrics to go along with it, they don't seem to mention the rest of the team that they were working with to understand the need. And you know what? No harm, no foul. It's just that I'm less likely to hire a person who has a portfolio of 10 things and five of them are experiments. I also get that it's a catch 22, right? If you don't have the experience, it's hard to get the experience. And so you need to fill in and show that you think about these things. Just like back in the day, if we hired a visual or interaction designer and some of their portfolio was, they went to an existing experience and they redesigned it. They were asked to, they just showed as an example.
Yeah.
I don't mind some of that actually.
Yeah.
I remember publishing a lot of UX Mag articles that were precisely that, like people redesigning experiences. I remember bad ones.
Yeah, a United Airlines one sticks out to me. Without giving away too much information that Banner wouldn't be pleased with, let's see if you could talk us through. So for listeners, give them an idea of the kind of conversational solutions or experiences that somebody joining your team might be involved with. How sophisticated, how complex, and then I think the important question to couple with that is, what are you going to look for in somebody's portfolio that gives you some indicators if they might have relevant experience for that kind of thing?
Right. Thank you, Elias. Yeah, maybe I'll answer the latter part first. So what would I be looking for in terms of examples, the types of experiences that they've helped to craft? And for that, I think I would, again, go back to behavior design and this ability to, especially in healthcare, approach people at the intersection of making it easy to do, as well as high motivation, right? As well as the right prompts or triggers. So that you probably have heard of BJ Fogg. So when you think about behavior design and the way that he describes it, that's really the sweet spot, is making it easy. And then when they're strongly motivated, they're more likely to act. Another maxim of behavior design is the ability to help someone feel successful. So that's why BJ Fogg wrote the book Tiny Habits. So you start small and you feel successful, and that propels you forward. When you apply that to something like healthcare or just health, you know, maintaining your health, it's very relevant because there's certain points of engagement that we have with patients, with customers, where we really want them to interact and be actively engaged in their health. For instance, someone who has diabetes or maybe pediatric asthma, right? They need to be taking certain actions in their life to help themselves increase their health, right? Again, going back to this, helping people help themselves. And you might call that engagement, or you might use other words for that, but where are the slips? Where are the points where they might slip off of a regimen or slip out of adherence with the medication that they're on? And you can't just send push notifications and expect people to see that on their phone and act upon it. That's just not enough. So we'll need to do more work in that space of becoming an actual health partner and being able to interact with people, maybe not on a daily basis if they don't want it, unless that's required, but how do you actually engage with someone in a way that provides them the right information at the right moment, in a way that keeps them coming back, that helps them build tiny habits of health, is a good way to look at a lot of what we're going to be trying to do more of. You know, there's commonly known platforms out there for that in terms of technology. You've got things like Zelf and others that we're working with that, and that's public knowledge. And it is a lot about that prompting. So that's going to be a big challenge for us. So we're going to be looking at designers who are adept at that. You know, how do we engage with someone along their health journey so that they have fewer slips, more engagement, proactive health, so that it doesn't become about treating people who are unhealthy. It becomes more about health, sometimes what I call health assurance instead of health insurance, and the ability to keep someone healthy.
In thinking about the healthcare space, in some ways it makes sense that someone like you who really got into design because you wanted to help people, you know, that's where you get to meet people who really need help head on in some ways. But it's also kind of a space that's fraught with really poorly designed experiences and super disjointed kind of records keeping and a lot of processes that people kind of find out of date and frustrating. So along with like design needs to kind of meet those challenges, are there like broader needs for like an enablement team across an organization like Banner Health or like other organizations kind of in that space where you also need key people in other positions around the organization to really make sure that the designers can do what they want to do and that information is kind of moving through the organization and connected in a way that kind of enables those sort of experiences?
No, 100%. I mean, design, of course, doesn't exist as a silo. And so you've got maybe leaders and teams involved in data, right? Data management, making sure master data is in place, making sure that's available across, you know, digital touch points so that we can know people across their interactions with our whole health system. That's extremely important. And Banner is very well positioned to do that. There's that. There's also considering when you think about other teams that you need to work with, operations, right? There's a lot that happens behind the scenes. You can make scheduling an appointment, for instance, extremely easy for someone. But if you don't have the doctors to fill those appointments, it doesn't matter. So you need to be able to manage, you know, doctors' calendars and schedules effectively. So operations, data. Another key area is architecture. That's another catch-22 we often run into when you're working with someone in system architecture is what I'm referring to, where you say, well, we don't know what the architecture should be because we don't know what the experience is going to be and we don't know what we can do with the experience because we're not sure if the architecture is there. So I just had a peer that joined our group who is head of architecture, extremely valuable with the team, extremely important person to you know, develop rapport with and interact with because we need to make sure the architecture is there to support the experiences. When I hire designers, I don't look for them to have all of those skills, but I do look for designers who have experience, ideally in global organizations, but can be fully domestic, but who have experience working with those different groups within an organization, whether it's operations, data, architecture, certainly developers. And I also look for people who do use probably an Agile and Scrum methodology for getting work done. And how to interact with those people and other groups along that life cycle of design and development and along the double diamond, pulling architects in early, for instance, when we're doing a Jake Knapp style design sprint in 5 days and just trying to generate some ideas based on how might we and test that with people, making sure that we have people from those groups involved early on.
And is it I'm guessing it's fairly important for the leaders, at least of those groups, to have some familiarity with design thinking. When we talk about UX Magazine back in 2012, I think Elias mentioned like back then it was a lot of pounding the table for a voice. And it feels like to a degree that fight was sort of won. But now like the reader base of UX Magazine is a lot broader because of it, because so many people now realize that experience design touches their work lives, their daily lives. Like, is it a challenge to get these groups to kind of meet you there, or are they already kind of primed with some degree of design thinking?
Yeah, I would say that they're primed with some degree, but part of my role as a leader is to, or you could call it educate, just share some of that knowledge, right? Even defining design for people can be helpful sometimes. And I tend to use the Herbert Simon definition of, you know, devising courses of action to move from a current state to a preferred future state. Defining the disciplines of design so that people don't just think of design as the people that color a button and figure out where that goes on a screen, right? Those other disciplines we talked about in terms of research and content and accessibility. So there is a need for that. I'm fortunate to be with an employer where there's good knowledge of that. I've heard colleagues actually say, hey, it's one of the reasons I love being here is we actually have a design group. But, you know, I think it's helpful to think back. I remember those days when we would say, oh, I wish design was at the table with the business, you know, and then there were the conversations that ensued about, well, sure, but design also needs to speak the language of business and be able to rationalize, you know, what we're doing and correlate the work that we do to business results. It's all true. But when I think, at least just speaking for myself, why was I thinking that way at the time? I want to be at the table. It was actually very altruistic. It went back to my earlier days of psychology to say, I'm doing this to help someone. That's why I'm in design. So whether I'm at the table or a really strong, you know, product director that I partner with is at the table, and they have the voice of the customer in their head and they're advocating for creating things that help people, kind of doesn't matter to me too much these days, as long as I know that the people at the table have that empathy for the customer, right? That it's pivoted from implementing technology to helping people. It is true, though, I'm often in those conversations. And one of the big parts of my role, too, is really encouraging people like product managers to work with designers early in the process, so that you get out of that practice of designers or developers, for that matter, just being order takers. It's hard to hire people into an organization if that's the culture, because who wants to do that? You want to practice your craft, but if you're really about helping people, you want to be involved early on so you can understand what they need firsthand and then also generate ideas together.
Yet it makes me wonder too, if like back in your Honeywell days, and maybe this is true now too, but I'm thinking like as you were working on internal HR solutions, like one of the pros that we identify in the book to that approach is that ideally you're probably like working, if you're going to automate a process and human resources, you're going to want to talk to the person who kind of understands how it currently works and maybe kind of co-create with them to help figure out like, well, we can automate this, but let's do it in a way that's actually better than what you were able to do by yourself. So it seems in terms of like spreading design thinking around an organization, and in that sense, like the person who's kind of helping you identify the task to automate and steer the automation also is an important piece of the design process. That might actually be, you might consider them a designer in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, that part of that Herbert Simon definition is everyone designs who devises courses of action. So I always clarify that by saying we all design because we all come up with what? Well, courses of action, right, is the definition of idea. So we all come up with ideas. But then you have people who are trained in and know the craft of product design or product management, et cetera. But yeah, if I think back to Honeywell, one of my best partners was Mark Burgess. He was actually our head of HR information technology. And we had many conversations from the day I started to how, you know, the HR portal at that time was really not well suited for efficiency necessarily. It literally had some spinning dogs on it. And it was just not quite there. We talked about personas and how instead of thinking about managers as people who want to kind of bifurcate themselves when they're interacting with a digital solution and choose whether they're an employee or choose whether they're a manager, bring that together and think more about personalization attributes. So we had those kinds of conversations, and he's a great partner. And all the way through to things like the chatbot interactions that we created or figuring out where robotics process automation would have a fit. That was a great example of design being at the table with technology and others to really devise a course of action. So it is important when hiring designers that the designers have some, you know, technical acumen. I think that's extremely important, because not only do designers need to be able to speak the language of business, but we need to be able to speak the language of technology. It's harder to solve problems when they come up if you're not speaking the same language and if you don't have some knowledge, but without going too far to tell a developer, hey, that's easy. Is that easy? You can just do that. No. Don't go there, right? But at least have enough information to speak the language.
They need that cross-functional, cross-organizational experience, ideally.
Yeah. And I look at that in resumes as well as in conversations to understand the people that they've worked with and how they've solved problems together.
Do you find that that's more... do you see agency or consultancy designers get more exposure, maybe not to the same depth? Like, do you find any trends with candidates in terms of like they're already inside of a big global organization versus they work with a consultancy that works with big globalizations,
right?
Global organizations. Yeah,
right. That's a great question. You know, I know from having worked with large global organizations for a number of years, like with Honeywell, I was there for 6.5 years. I worked in human resources, but then I also worked in aerospace for a bit. And I know that being in a place for a good long time is important, because you build relationships, you learn the domain, You learn the constraints as well as what the opportunities might be for the business. And that's actually really important in terms of your maturation as a designer to stay with a place for a while. There's plenty of large organizations where you can stay with them for a while and move to different jobs within the organization. Honeywell was one of those places. So I do look for that. Agency is fine. I have agency experience in my background as well. And that's kind of good experience to have because you learn how to work with business developers who are out there pounding the pavement, you know, getting with clients, trying to understand their needs. Sometimes they'll bring you along and you get experience in that way as well. But I would say that I do look, when I look at a resume, if I see 6 months here, a year there, 6 months here, 8 months there,
yeah,
it's more likely I'm going to pass on the candidate because I want to see someone who's built relationships and actually seen some of the organizational design stresses that come up, has seen how change occurs in
organizations. Lived through evolutions within an organization, yeah.
Absolutely.
Cool. Well, I mean, we could end with sort of an esoteric question for fun. Wait.
Let's do it.
Just because it sounds like you have one, yeah.
Unless there are some practical things we didn't get to, Elias, that you want to
I feel like this on. Is I don't want to
cut that part short.
This feels like a complete first conversation. I could see some room for a follow-up after more time, but I think, yeah. Is there anything, Aaron, that you were like dying to get into that just didn't feel like there was space for that you think would be helpful for listeners?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably, maybe it's a follow-up conversation, but I think generationally there are differences as well, whether you talk about millennials or others. You do see a trend sometimes with younger designers where they just kind of want to have it all right away. And, you know, was I that way when I was a designer and younger? Yeah, maybe I was, but I see it a little bit more now where designers expect respect just out of the box and want to work across projects and across teams. And I appreciate that ambition, but I also know that it's really important, again, to stick on a, whether you call it a project or you call it a continuous product life cycle, to stick with that for a time.
Yeah.
And kind of earn that respect by demonstrating yourself as someone who can not only design amazing interfaces, whether conversational or otherwise, but also demonstrate that you can build relationships that when tough situations come up, whether that's a conflict between a designer and a developer, or maybe a developer that's offshore instead of onshore, or you get to a conflict with a product manager because you created this wonderful experience and you can't launch 100% of it. You need to start with 50% of it as an MVP. You need to experience those things and figure out how to really be kind, assertive, productive in those situations as a younger designer.
It's interesting that you brought that up as a generational thing that if you made it sound like that's something we're faced with more now than earlier, but I sort of see that as something that is maybe something that hasn't changed. That was there. Like I can think of 2011 hiring a designer who was a great designer, actually fantastic person to work with, who had just finished a design degree. Even having a UX centered degree was relatively new still at the time. But then they went immediately into a design MBA. And so then there was this expectancy that they should be leading a team and managing because they have this management degree. They learned really quickly that didn't quite make sense in that environment. They ended up being phenomenal, as I said, so I'm certainly not knocking them. But that was way back then. It sounds like that's one of the things that hasn't really changed, too, is like earning your depth of experience and wisdom.
Yeah,
in the design.
Whether you're a designer in any role, just like there's change, you know, there's experience you need to have to become a manager or a leader. You know, I always tell my people, you know, I love my people. I care about you first as a human being, way more than the projects you're working on, etc. So my job as a leader now is a lot about removing impediments for them, helping them grow. But it takes some time to get into a role like that and to know enough and having been there and done that enough. To maybe see a problem coming, identify a blind spot for someone, help them grow in certain ways. That takes time to build that experience.
Yeah.
So be patient and, you know, struggle through the tough times and see that as something that's really just growing you as an ability to become a more senior member of the team.
thank you for doing this and like opening up and sharing. I think it will help a lot of listeners. I think it's probably obvious that this could be as helpful to your peers, Aaron, as it might be to somebody who's just entering design. And everywhere in between, there's so much excitement and confusion in the space right now. There's a lot of like, how does this transfer? Does it? Am I translatable to this? Even people that are that have solid jobs in conversational design, I'm hearing from regularly with these same types of questions. So I think it was awesome that you came and just kind of shared with listeners in the community. I'm glad you could do it with us.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, just try to find a company that you can work with, a team that you can work with, where you've got an empathizing manager, where they're going to appreciate the skills you have to help you grow, you know, other skills as well through the challenges. Or, I think it'd be in good shape. Just be open to learning.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah. Well, thanks, Aaron. Nice. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
And we can save the esoteric question for next conversation.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right.
Aaron,
this was
a lot of fun. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining this ongoing conversation about conversational AI. Be sure to subscribe to Invisible Machines wherever you get your podcasts. And if you feel so inclined, please leave us a review on the Apple Podcast app. You can also watch these conversations on the Invisible Machines YouTube channel. This podcast is produced for UX Magazine in partnership with OneReach.ai. Over the past 5 years, our team of nearly 200 engineers, scientists, experienced designers, anthropologists, and linguists have been developing Generative Studio X, an award-winning platform that has the lone distinction of being named a leader by every major analyst group. GSX is a complete environment for hosting, creating, analyzing, and scaling your own digital teammates called Intelligent Digital Workers. For an interactive demo of IDWs in action and to learn more about the GSX platform, head to onereach.ai. This podcast would not be possible without the hard work and dedication of executive producer Elias Parker and producer Kate Timchenko. Our video and audio editor is Michael Litvinov, and we rely on support from the marketing team at onereach.ai, including Allison Harshberger, Anastasia Nechtalio, and Vera Prokodko. Thanks again, and we look forward to connecting with you next week, right here on Invisible Machines.